Hey, before we jump in, this deep dive is brought to you by Cert Fuel. They've got a full Series 3 course with like adaptive study quizzes, smart flashcards, and unlimited practice exams weighted exactly like the real thing. You check it out at CertFuel.com.
Definitely worth checking out.
Yeah, for sure. Okay, so I want you to imagine taking a 120-question exam that basically dictates the entire trajectory of your career in finance, right? The Series 3.
Oh, yeah. The pressure is real.
It's intense. You sit down, the clock starts ticking, and you come across a concept that seems like just one small piece of the puzzle. But here is the terrifying reality.
And it really is terrifying.
Right. If you misunderstand this single concept, it doesn't just cost you one point. It mathematically forces you to pick the exact, definitive wrong answer for roughly 70% of the test.
Yeah, that's not an exaggeration.
No. You will confidently choose the mirror opposite of the correct answer, question after question, all while thinking you are absolutely crushing it. That boss-level concept, the fulcrum that the entire exam rests on, is the basis.
It is the great differentiator, honestly. The exam writers, they build their traps specifically around it because memorization shatters when applied to the basis. You either understand the mechanics of it in your bones or you fail the practical application questions. There's just no middle ground.
So if your brain works a little faster, if you have ADHD and standard dry textbook lectures about finance put you into an immediate coma, You are in the right place today.
We are definitely not just reading definitions.
We are going to make this sticky, we're going to make it weird, and we are going to use absurd scenarios. We're going to build a movie in your head with recurring characters.
I like the movie idea.
Because when the exam throws a convoluted 4-paragraph trick question at you, understanding the underlying why, like the gritty trading floor reality of how these markets actually move, that is your only defense.
That is exactly the mindset you need. You have to step out of the textbook and onto the trading floor. And to do that, before we can even begin to talk about hedging strategies or, you know, who makes money or who faces profit margin compression, we have to lay down the absolute foundational math. The bedrock.
The golden rule. I know what it is, but I want to derive why it is what it is. So the formula for the basis is local cash price, which is also known as the spot price, minus the futures price. Cash minus futures. Never flip it.
Never flip it. The fixed order of that subtraction is completely non-negotiable.
But wait, let's pause and figure out why it's in that order. Because human nature, especially under exam stress, wants to put the bigger number first, right? Or like the more official benchmark number first.
Yeah, people look at the screen and see the big number and just start there.
Exactly. The futures price on the Chicago Board of Trade screen feels like the real number, so people naturally want to subtract the local cash price from it. Why is the local cash price the anchor?
Well, because the cash market, the actual physical commodity sitting in a warehouse or the actual bond you hold in your portfolio, that is reality. It is the tangible asset right in front of you.
Right. It's real life.
Exactly. The futures market is just a derivative. It's a theoretical promise of a future reality. As a commercial operator, you live and die by the cash market. You use the futures market to protect it.
Okay.
Therefore, you always start with your reality. Where am I right now in the physical cash market relative to the theoretical futures market? Hence, cash minus futures.
That makes total sense. You start with the physical coin in your hand and you compare it to the digital screen in Chicago. Now, because this is a subtraction problem, the math dictates that the result can be a positive number or it can be a negative number. But traders don't walk around the pits yelling about negative numbers, do they?
They do not. The industry has its own shorthand. If the basis is a positive number, meaning your local cash price is numerically higher than the futures price, it is quoted as being over. Cash is over futures.
Okay, so if local cash is $5 and futures are $4, the basis is $1 over.
You got it.
And if it's the other way around, if local cash is $4 and the futures price is $5, the math says 4 minus 5 is negative 1.
Exactly. But they don't say negative $1. They say the basis is 1 under. Cash is $1 under futures. And this brings us to, honestly, a massive psychological hurdle for people studying this material.
Yes. Let me set this up for the listener. I've got an interactive question for you.
Yeah.
Stop what you're doing, look away from your phone, and think about this for a second.
Lock in.
You're staring at a trading screen. The futures price for a commodity is $10. Your local cash price is $8. Your basis is $2 under. It's a deeply negative number. Okay, does this mean the market is crashing? Does a negative basis mean the system is broken or that the commodity is practically worthless? I'll give you a beat to lock in your answer.
It is literally the most common pitfall in the first chapter of study.
Right, because in almost every other aspect of finance, negative implies loss or failure or distress. But what is the actual reality here?
The reality is that a negative basis being under is perfectly normal.
Perfectly normal.
Completely. In fact, for storable physical commodities like grain or metals or energy, a negative basis is the standard everyday baseline expectation.
Mm-hmm.
Does not mean the market is broken. It simply provides a geographic and temporal map of where the cash market sits relative to the futures market.
I want to dig into that map. Why is it normal for cash to be cheaper than futures? Like, if I could buy a bushel of corn locally right now for $8, why on earth would the futures contract for delivery in 6 months be $10?
Because of time, basically, and the physical constraints of reality. Think about it. If you buy the cash corn today for $8, what are you going to do with it for the next 6 months?
Right. I can't just leave it in my living room.
Exactly. You have to rent space in a commercial grain elevator. You have to buy insurance on it in case the elevator catches fire. You have to pay to keep it aerated so it doesn't rot.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
And crucially, you have tied up your capital. That $8 could have been earning interest in a treasury bill, but instead is locked inside a giant pile of corn. All of those things. Storage space, insurance, and the opportunity cost of capital, they are collectively called carrying charges.
Okay, so the futures price is higher because it implicitly includes all those carrying charges. If I buy the futures contract for $10, I don't have to worry about silos or insurance or rats eating the grain for 6 months. The market is pricing in the convenience of not having to hold it physically.
That's spot on.
Therefore, the physical cash price today must be lower. It must be negative relative to futures to account for the burden of storage.
You've just deduced the fundamental structure of a carrying charge market, which is also known as contango. A negative basis is merely the numerical representation of the cost of physical storage.
Contango, great word.
It really is. And if the cash price wasn't below the futures price to account for those costs, the physical supply chain would completely break down because no one would be financially incentivized to store anything.
So a negative basis is just a location pin on a map and a timestamp on a calendar. It is not a value judgment at all. But that brings us to the next layer of complexity. If the futures price is this big, flashing national benchmark that everyone can see, what causes your specific local cash price to detach from it and widen or narrow that gap?
Well, we have to look at the localized drivers for that. The futures price is a universal standardized benchmark. It assumes a perfect world.
All right.
But the basis is the bucket that catches all the messy, unpredictable, dirty realities of the actual world.
Mm.
The most immediate driver is local supply and local demand.
Let's use an absurd analogy to make this stick for people. Let's step completely away from the agricultural markets for a second. Think about buying a brand new car.
A very relatable framework. I like it.
The futures price is the national MSRP, the manufacturer's suggested retail price. It is the number they flash at the end of the glossy television commercial, starting at $30,000. That is the benchmark. Everyone in the country sees the exact same $30,000 number on their TV screen.
Sure. But when you actually walk into your local dealership to physically buy the car, the cash market transaction, you almost never pay exactly $30,000.
Exactly. The dealer has taped a weird handwritten sticker right next to the official Windows sticker. That handwritten sticker is the basis. Now, why does the dealer change the price?
They have their reasons.
Let's say that specific local dealership accidentally ordered 500 identical neon green minivans, and they operate in a tiny rural town of 200 people. That is an apocalyptic local supply surplus.
A total disaster for that dealer.
Nobody wants these minivans. So the dealer slashes the local cash price to $25,000 just to get them off the lot.
Okay, let's tie that back to the formula. Cash minus futures. The local cash price is $25,000. The national futures MSRP is $30,000. 25 minus 30 is a negative $5,000.
So the basis is $5,000 under.
Exactly. A local surplus weakened the basis, driving it deeply negative.
But what if we flip the scenario? Let's say there is a massive national shortage of microchips, and this local dealership happens to have the absolute last three highly sought-after sports cars in a five-state radius,
mm-hmm.
and five wealthy buyers walk onto the lot at the exact same time. That is an extreme local shortage and high local demand.
The dealer realizes the leverage they hold immediately. They take a Sharpie, they cross out the $30,000 MSRP, and they write $40,000 on the window.
Cash minus futures. Local cash is $40,000. National benchmark is 30,000. The basis is positive 10,000, 10,000 over. A local shortage strengthened the basis, pushing it massively positive.
And this perfectly illustrates why the exact same asset, whether it's a car, a bushel of wheat, or a barrel of crude oil, can have a completely different basis depending on which specific location you are standing in. Every local environment has its own unique set of constraints, weather patterns, and logistical bottlenecks.
Which means we need to introduce our first recurring character. We need to look at how geography physically alters the math. Listener, if you want this to survive in your memory during a grueling exam, you need to picture these concepts as a movie. So let me introduce you to Farmer Fred.
A vital player in our market ecosystem. What is Fred's situation?
Farmer Fred is chronically stressed out. He grows corn. But Fred does not live anywhere near Chicago. Fred lives way, way out in the middle of nowhere. Geographically, his farm is incredibly isolated. It's beautiful, the soil is great, but it is hours away from any major highway or river system.
Oh, that's a problem.
And this isolation is the most critical factor when we talk about transportation costs and the basis.
Because a futures contract is a highly rigid, standardized legal document. It does not just say, deliver corn somewhere in the United States. It specifies exact approved delivery points. For the CBOT corn contract, for example, the delivery must take place at specific exchange-approved grain elevators along the Illinois River.
So the futures price you see flashing on the screen at $6 a bushel is implicitly pricing the corn as if it is already sitting at that approved elevator on the Illinois River.
Precisely. The benchmark assumes the delivery logistics are already completely solved. But Farmer Fred's corn is not at the Illinois River. It is in a silo in the middle of nowhere. If Fred actually wanted to satisfy a short futures contract by delivering physical grain, the exchange is not going to dispatch a fleet of complimentary trucks to go pick it up.
No free shipping and commodities.
That's definitely not.
Fred is entirely on the hook for the logistics. He has to hire the semi-trucks, he has to pay for the diesel fuel, he has to pay the drivers, he has to physically move thousands of bushels of corn across the state to that approved delivery point.
And that brutal logistical reality is instantly priced into his local basis. Imagine a local cash buyer drives out to Fred's farm. The buyer says, look, Fred, I know the Chicago futures price is $6, but if I buy your corn right here, right now, I am the one who has to pay the freight to eventually get it to the river or a processing plant. That freight is going to cost me 50 cents a bushel. Therefore, I will only offer you $5.50.
Wow. The local cash price had to absorb the transportation cost. The freight cost acted like a localized tax on the value of Fred's grain.
So we run the formula. Cash minus futures, $5.50 minus $6. The basis at Fred's farm is 50 cents under. And this leads us to an unbreakable rule of geographic basis. The farther you are from the approved delivery point, the weaker or more negative your local basis will be.
Exam trap alert. I am flashing the red lights right now. Pay very close attention right here.
This is a big one.
The exam writers know exactly how your brain works. They will present a scenario where a farm is located incredibly far away from the delivery point and transportation costs are extremely high. The human brain naturally associates high cost and far away with the word strong. You think, wow, it costs so much money to move this, the number must be getting stronger. Do not fall for it.
It is a fatal error in logic for this exam. Distance does not add value to the commodity at its origin. It drains value from it. Distance is a penalty. It is a tax.
Exactly. The farther you are, the more expensive it is to move, which means the local cash buyer is going to deduct a massive penalty from your price. High freight costs drain the local cash price down, down, down. Therefore, distance makes the basis weaker and more negative.
It really is that simple.
But wait, if you happen to own a massive commercial farm located directly across the street from the approved CBOT delivery elevator, your transportation costs are practically zero. A forklift could move it. In that scenario, your local cash price will be nearly identical to the futures price. Your basis would be very strong, perhaps completely flat to the board.
So we have established that physical distance creates a basis differential, but geography is only one part of the standardization puzzle. We also have to talk about the physical quality of the commodity itself.
Right, because nature doesn't care about a Chicago Board of Trade rulebook.
Yeah.
What if Fred's corn is weird? Let's say he had a bizarre weather pattern this year, and his corn isn't the perfect golden standard that everyone expects.
This introduces the concept of deliverable grades. When a futures exchange creates a contract, they must define exactly what is being traded so that buyers know exactly what they are getting. They establish what is called a par grade, or a basis grade. For corn, it might be number two yellow corn with specific maximum moisture and damage allowances.
So the price on the screen is for that exact perfect par grade.
Exactly. But if the exchange only allowed number two yellow corn to be delivered, the contract would be way too restrictive. It wouldn't reflect the realities of agriculture, and commercial hedgers just wouldn't use it. So to ensure the market remains liquid and useful, the exchange publishes a schedule of alternate grades that are legally permissible to deliver against the contract.
But they don't let you deliver substandard corn for the premium price. Right. That would break the system.
Right. Exactly. They institute a system of mandated premiums and discounts. If Fred has an incredible harvest and he grows a premium grade, say, number one yellow corn, which is measurably superior to the par grade, the exchange rules dictate that if he delivers it, the buyer must pay a designated premium above the futures price. This raises the effective local value of his crop.
And if Fred's weird weather year resulted in corn that is a little damp or a little damaged, a discount grade like number three yellow corn, he is still legally allowed to deliver it, but he takes a massive haircut on the price. The exchange mandates a discount penalty.
And here is the crucial synthesis for the listener. The physical commodity that is actually changing hands in the real world is almost never priced strictly at the flat futures price. The actual realized local price is the futures price, mathematically adjusted for location, the freight cost, and simultaneously adjusted for grade, the premium or discount.
Wait, let me piece this together. If I take the pure theoretical futures price and I subtract the 50-cent freight penalty because Fred lives in the middle of nowhere, and then I subtract another 10-cent penalty because his corn is a little damp, I've adjusted for location and grade. That total adjustment, I mean, that's 60 cents, that is the basis.
You have nailed it. The basis is the sum total of every real-world imperfection. It is the mathematical bridge between a pristine theoretical derivative contract and a messy physical reality. When you look at the basis, you are looking at the combined weight of freight logistics, storage constraints, and quality discrepancies.
That is a total light bulb moment for me. The futures price is the theory. The basis is the reality. But up until now, we've treated time as static. We know that distance affects the basis. We know that weird, damp corn affects the basis. But what happens when the clock runs out? Futures contracts have an expiration date. They are basically a ticking time bomb.
This brings us to the mechanical heart of the futures market, which is convergence. We established earlier that carrying charges, the cost of renting the silo, buying insurance, and tying up capital widen the basis. The more time there is until a contract expires, the more it costs to store the physical commodity.
Because if the contract doesn't expire for 9 months, you have to pay 9 months worth of rent on that silo. That's a massive carrying charge, so the cash price has to be dragged way down below the futures price. The basis is very wide, very negative.
But time only moves in one direction. Every single day that passes, you have one less day of storage to pay for, one less day of insurance to carry. The embedded carrying costs begin to evaporate. And as those costs decay, an inevitable mathematical gravity takes over.
I call this the inevitable finish line. Let's build another visual model in your head, listener. Picture a massive oval running track. We have two runners lining up for a race. One runner is wearing a jersey that says cash. The other runner is wearing a jersey that says futures.
I like this visual. The finish line is the expiration date of the contract.
Exactly. Now, when the starting gun goes off, say, 6 months before the expiration date, those two runners might be completely staggered. They might be 50 yards apart on the track. The basis is wide. The cash runner is way behind the futures runner because of all the heavy carrying costs he's wearing.
He's literally weighed down.
Right. But as they run, as time ticks away and they get closer and closer to that finish line, a physical reality starts pulling them together.
What pulls them together is the threat and the reality of physical delivery. As the contract enters the delivery month, often referred to as the spot month, the abstract derivative becomes a tangible reality. The option to actually deliver physical goods against the futures contract is now active.
But how does that actually force the prices to match? Why wouldn't they just cross the finish line far apart?
Because of arbitragers. Let's break down the exact mechanism, because understanding this removes all the mystery.
Well, play it out for me.
Let's say it is the final week of trading before expiration. We are right at the finish line. If the local cash price at the delivery elevator was $5, but the expiring futures contract was still trading at $7, what would a professional trader do?
Oh, I see it. It's free money. The trader would immediately buy the physical cash corn at the elevator for $5. In the exact same millisecond, they would short the futures contract for $7. They now own the corn, and they have a legal obligation to sell it for $7.
And then?
Because we are in the delivery window, they just hand over the warehouse receipt for the corn they bought at $5, satisfy the $7 short, and they just locked in a $2 risk-free profit.
Exactly. And they wouldn't do it just once. They would do it thousands of times. Algorithmic trading desks would do it millions of times. They would relentlessly buy the cheap cash market, which creates massive buying pressure, driving the cash price up. And they would relentlessly short the expensive futures market, creating massive selling pressure, driving the futures price down.
They act like a vice grip. Their buying and selling pressure literally crushes the two prices together.
That vice grip is convergence. Arbitragers will continue to exploit any gap until the gap is smaller than the transaction cost required to execute the trade. By the time those two runners cross the finish line, by the time the contract officially expires, the cash price and the futures price have been forced to be virtually identical at the delivery location. The basis, the gap between the two runners, has shrunk. It narrows towards zero.
I'm throwing the exam trap alert flag again. Listener, engrave this rule into your mind right now. The basis narrows towards zero into delivery. It converges. It does not widen.
No, it never widens into delivery.
If you are reading a test question and one of the options suggests that the basis will widen as it enters the delivery month, or if it implies that the basis remains a fixed, constant number throughout the life of the contract, that is a trap. They are lying to you to test your fundamental understanding of arbitrage. The basis narrows. It converges.
And this reality of convergence, the fact that the basis is a living, breathing number that changes every single day, introduces the most critical concept for commercial operators, basis risk.
Let's unpack that. Why does Farmer Fred hedge in the first place? He hedges because he is terrified that the global price of corn is going to collapse before he can harvest. He wants to lock in a price.
He wants to remove outright price risk. Outright price risk is the existential threat that a massive global bumper crop drives the price of corn from $6 down to $2, bankrupting his farm. So he sells a futures contract. But because the basis moves independently, because it shrinks over time, because a local trucking shortage could blow out freight costs, because local weather could affect his grade, the hedge does not lock in a perfectly static, to the penny, final price.
Wait, so he didn't actually eliminate his risk completely. He just traded a massive, terrifying monster of a problem for a much smaller, more manageable problem.
That is exactly what a hedge is. It is the substitution of a catastrophic risk for a manageable risk. You swap outright price risk for basis risk.
Yeah, okay, makes sense.
Basis risk is the uncertainty regarding exactly how the local basis will move between the moment you place the hedge and the moment you lift it. Outright prices can swing by dollars. The basis typically only swings by cents. Hedging works because basis risk is mathematically much smaller than outright price risk, but you must always remember that basis risk is never actually zero.
Okay, let's take a deep breath. We have covered a mountain of mechanics so far. We know what the basis is, cash minus futures. We know why it exists to account for time, storage, geography, and weird corn. And we know its ultimate destiny is to converge to zero at expiration because arbitragers will crush any discrepancies. Now we are entering the absolute danger zone of this material. This is the directional dance.
This section is the most direction-sensitive material in the entire curriculum. If your internal compass is backward here, you will invert every single answer regarding hedger profitability.
We need to define exactly what strengthening and weakening mean mathematically before we introduce any money or any business operations, because we are dealing almost entirely with negative numbers, and human brains are notoriously terrible at processing the movement of negative numbers.
It really requires a paradigm shift in how you visualize math. Let's start with strengthening. A strengthening basis means the basis is becoming algebraically more positive or less negative. The local cash price is gaining ground on the futures price. The movement is directed upward.
Give me a ladder analogy. I need a visual.
Imagine a ladder planted deep inside a hole in the ground. Ground level is zero. Let's say the basis starts at 10 under. You are 10 feet underground on that ladder. Over the course of a month, the local market tightens and the basis moves to 5 under. You climbed up the ladder. You are now only 5 feet underground.
Exam trap alert. I am stopping you right there because this is where the test gets tricky. The basis moved from 10 under to 5 under. But 5 under is still a negative number. How can a market be strengthening if the number is still negative?
Because the terms strengthening and weakening do not describe the final state of the number. They describe the direction of travel. You started 10 feet underground. You climbed up 5 feet. You are still in the hole. Your position is still technically negative relative to ground level, but you moved up. You strengthened your position relative to where you began. The cash price gained ground.
Okay, I like that. Up the ladder is strengthening, even if you're still in the dark. Now define weakening.
Weakening is the exact mathematical opposite. The basis becomes more negative or less positive. The cash price is losing ground, slipping further away from the futures price. The movement is directed downward. If you were standing at 5 under on your ladder and you climb down to 10 under, you are weakening. You are moving deeper into the hole.
And just to be completely thorough, this logic holds up even if you were above ground, right? Like, let's say there's a massive local shortage and the basis is actually positive. You start at 7 over. You are 7 feet in the air above ground level, but then the local shortage eases up and the basis drops to 3 over.
That is a weakening basis. You went from positive 7 down to positive 3. The number is still positive. You were still above ground, but the direction of travel was downward. Cash lost ground to futures. Up is strengthening. Down is weakening.
Okay, we have the mechanical rules of the ladder locked in. But why do we care? Who is watching this ladder and how does it affect their bank account? It is time to bring back Farmer Fred, and it is time to introduce his counterpart in the market ecosystem.
We need to look at both sides of a commercial hedge.
Let's review Fred first. Farmer Fred is a producer. He grows a physical commodity. As harvest approaches, he has silos filling up with physical, tangible corn that he intends to sell in the cash market. He is terrified prices will drop, so he places a short hedge. He is considered long the cash commodity because he literally possesses the physical asset, and he is short futures because he sold derivative contracts to lock in a price. Fred is our definitive short hedger.
And every transaction requires a counterparty.
Enter Baker Betty. Baker Betty lives in a major metropolitan area. She runs a massive industrial bakery. She produces millions of absurdly giant muffins every week. To maintain her operations, she requires thousands of tons of flour and grain. She doesn't own it today, but she knows she must buy it in the cash market in 3 months. She is terrified that a drought will cause grain prices to spike, wiping out her profit margins.
So she executes a long hedge. She is short the cash commodity because she has a massive future physical requirement that she has not yet fulfilled. And she is long futures because she buys derivative contracts to protect against rising prices. Baker Betty is our definitive long hedger.
We have Fred the seller, the short hedger. We have Betty the buyer, the long hedger. They are locking horns in the market. Expert, what is the single most important rule to anchor the listener's brain to when answering directional questions on the Series 3?
The absolute anchor, the true north of your exam strategy, is this. The short hedger owns the cash commodity.
Why is that the anchor point? Why not anchor to the futures?
Because if you own a physical asset, if you hold it in your hands, you intrinsically want the value of that specific asset to increase. Fred owns the cash corn. Therefore, Fred wants the cash price to rise relative to the futures market. He wants cash to gain ground. Whatever lifts the cash price relative to the futures price mathematically lifts Fred's final net selling price. Therefore, a strengthening basis helps the short hedger.
And because futures trading is effectively a zero-sum transfer of risk between these participants, if a market dynamic helps Fred, it must mathematically hurt his counterparty.
Correct. If a strengthening basis helps the short hedger, it unequivocally hurts the long hedger, Betty.
Let me push back on this because I am putting myself in the mind of the test taker. I'm looking at a question about Baker Buddy. She is going to the market to buy grain for her bakery. If I'm a buyer, wouldn't I want to see a strong market? The word strong sounds positive, healthy, robust. I want to buy from a strong market. Why is this bad for her?
You have just walked directly into the most lethal psychological trap the exam sets. The test writers rely heavily on your positive semantic association with the word strong. You must divorce emotion from the terminology. A strong basis is not a compliment about the health of the economy. It is a sterile mathematical reality, indicating that the physical cash price is high relative to the benchmark.
Oh, see now, strong just means expensive.
Exactly. Anchor back to Fred. A strong basis means the cash price is flexing its muscles. It is gaining ground. It is becoming more expensive. If you are Fred the seller, a strong, expensive cash price is a glorious thing. You get paid more. But if you are Baker Betty, the buyer, a strong, expensive cash price is a nightmare. It means your raw material costs are surging and your profit margins are being compressed. Therefore, a strengthening basis severely hurts the buyer. It hurts the long hedger.
So strong equals expensive cash. Sellers love it. Buyers hate it. What about the flip side? A weakening basis.
A weakening basis means the cash price is losing ground. It is slipping down the ladder. It is getting cheaper relative to the futures benchmark.
If the cash price is getting weaker and cheaper, Fred the seller is devastated. His localized revenue is dropping. A weakening basis hurts the short hedger. It compresses his profit margin.
But Baker Betty is elated. The physical commodity she's forced to buy in the spot market is now relatively cheaper than the futures price she used to hedge. A weakening basis lowers her overall net purchase price. Her profit margins expand. Therefore, a weakening basis helps the long hedger.
Let's lock this in with a rapid-fire drill. Listener, I am talking directly to you. This is an interactive pop quiz, and it mimics the exact syntax you will see on the screen at the testing center. Listen closely. A manufacturer is hedging a future purchase of raw industrial metals. Between the time the hedge is placed and the time it is lifted, the basis moves from 2 over to 6 over. Does this basis movement expand or compress their profit margins?
Let's walk through the analytical framework step by step.
I'll give them a second to process. Manufacturer hedging a future purchase. Basis moves from 2 over to 6 over. Profit margin expansion or compression? Take a second.
Got your answer.
Okay, let's break it down. Expert, take the wheel.
Step 1. Identify the hedger's natural position. The prompt says a manufacturer hedging a future purchase. A purchaser is a buyer. A buyer is a long hedger. They are in the exact same position as Baker Betty. Step 2. Analyze the mathematical direction of the basis move. It went from positive 2, which is 2 over, to positive 6, which is 6 over. The cash price gained ground relative to futures. It climbed the ladder. That is mathematically a strengthening basis.
Step 3. Connect the mechanics. We have a buyer facing a strengthening basis. A strengthening basis means the local cash market is getting stronger, which means it is getting more expensive. Does a buyer want to be forced to pay a more expensive local price?
Absolutely not. An unexpectedly expensive cash market increases their raw material costs. Increased costs lead directly to profit margin compression. They are hurt by the move. If you concluded that their margins were compressed, you have successfully navigated the trap.
You completely stripped the emotion out of it. You didn't guess based on the word strong. You followed the mechanical steps. Identify hedger, identify direction, apply rule. But theory is one thing. I want to see the receipts. I want to see exactly how this abstract concept of a ladder actually impacts the physical dollars in Farmer Fred's bank account.
To do that, we must move into the precise dollar-for-dollar mathematics of hedging. The exam will not merely ask you if someone's margins expand or compress. They will require you to calculate the final net price down to the cent.
Welcome to the math section, everyone. How do we calculate this?
We use a singular foundational formula for evaluating a completed hedge. The effective net price, whether it is the net selling price realized by Fred or the net purchase price paid by Betty, is always equal to the initial futures price plus the ending basis.
I'm going to repeat that slowly. The effective net price equals the initial futures price plus the ending basis.
That is it. A hedge, contrary to popular belief, does not lock in a single, unmovable, guaranteed price. It locks in that initial futures price, plus whatever local basis differential exists on the exact day you lift the hedge and execute the cash transaction.
Let's run a scenario with real numbers. Let's look at Farmer Fred's ledger.
Fred is our short hedger, a producer selling grain. Let's say it's spring, he's planting his crop, and he decides to hedge his future harvest. He looks at the CBOT screen and sells December corn futures at $8.50 per bushel, $8.50. Now, Fred has been farming for 30 years. He knows his local market. Historically, at harvest time, his local basis is 10 cents under the futures price.
Okay, let's pause and figure out what Fred thinks is going to happen. He locked in the futures leg at $8.50. He expects the basis to be 10 under, which is a negative 10 cents. According to the formula, we take the initial futures price, $8.50, and we add the expected ending basis, which is negative 10 cents. Adding a negative is just subtraction. So $8.50 minus 10 cents. Fred's expected net selling price is $8.40 per bushel.
Correct. That is the figure he gives to his accountant to project his autumn revenue. But remember, the core lesson of basis risk, the basis is a living variable. It moves based on local supply and demand. So let's introduce a plot twist. Harvest arrives. Fred is ready to sell his physical grain to the local elevator and buy back his futures contracts to lift the hedge. But this year, there was a localized drought in his county. The local supply of corn is incredibly tight. The local elevator is desperate for grain.
A local shortage, we know what that does. That drives the local cash price up relative to the benchmark.
Exactly. Because of the shortage, the local basis does not settle at the historical 10 under. It strengthens. It climbs the ladder and settles at 5 under.
It moved from negative 10 cents to negative 5 cents. It strengthened. Okay, so what is Fred's actual realized reality? Go back to the formula. Initial futures price plus ending basis. The initial futures price he locked in back in the spring is carved in stone. It is still 850. But the ending basis is now minus 5 cents. 850 plus a negative 5 cents gives us a brand new actual net selling price of $8.45 per bushel. 845.
And this is where the power of the mechanics is revealed. Look at the delta between his expectation and his reality. He expected a basis of 10 under. The market gave him a basis of 5 under. The basis strengthened, moving in his favor by exactly 5 cents.
Now look at his bank account. He expected a net price of 840. He actually received a net price of 845. His net price improved by exactly 5 cents. The shift in the basis flowed directly, dollar for dollar, penny for penny, into his final revenue.
This perfectly validates our earlier rule. A strengthening basis helps the short hedger. The basis strengthened by a nickel, and Fred made an extra nickel per bushel on his entire crop. And we can immediately see the zero-sum symmetry here. Imagine Baker Betty was hedging a purchase in that exact same county. She expected to pay based on a 10-under basis, but the basis strengthened to 5-under. That exact same 5-cent strengthening would pass directly through to her formula, raising her net buying cost by 5 cents.
It would compress her margins by the exact same nickel that expanded Fred's margins. Okay, pattern interrupt.
Yeah.
If you are walking your dog right now or staring blankly at a spreadsheet at work, pause and visualize this with me. I need this analogy burned into your temporal lobe. Picture a long printed receipt from a grocery store. The futures leg of your hedge, that 850, is the big, bold, printed subtotal at the bottom of the receipt. The ink is dry. It cannot be changed. The futures market locked that massive chunk of risk in place.
But the receipt isn't the final amount you pay.
No. The basis is a tiny, crumpled up, yellow sticky note that someone stapled onto the very bottom of the receipt. On that sticky note is a scribbled plus or minus number. You can't alter the printed ink of the subtotal. But if the local market changes the number on that sticky note by a nickel, the final total that comes out of your wallet changes by exactly a nickel. The basis is just the localized sticky note adjustment stapled onto the end of the global benchmark.
That is arguably the most accurate way to conceptualize hedging. The derivative contract acts as a massive shield against macroeconomic price collapses, while the basis sticky note simply manages the microeconomic logistics of your specific zip code.
I love that. But here's the problem. Up until this very moment, we have spent 45 minutes talking exclusively about physical, tangible things. We've talked about corn, silos, moisture content, semi-trucks, diesel fuel, and giant muffins. It is very easy to visualize a sticky note attached to a pile of grain. But the Series 3 exam is not just an agricultural test. A massive portion of the curriculum and a modern trading volume is dedicated to financial futures.
This is a critical pivot. When we transition from agricultural commodities to financial instruments, specifically interest rate futures and treasury bonds, the intuition required to understand the basis shifts dramatically.
Right, because there are no semi-trucks for treasury bonds. We need a new character. Farmer Fred and Baker Betty are retired for the day. Let me introduce you to Treasury Tom. Treasury Tom does not own a tractor, and he does not care about localized droughts. Treasury Tom wears a meticulously tailored suit. He works in a glass tower in Manhattan, and he stares at a wall of Bloomberg terminals. Tom trades U.S. Treasury note futures.
Treasury Tom operates in a purely digital, rate-driven environment. We previously defined the basis in agricultural terms as being heavily influenced by the cost of carry, the cost of renting the silo and buying the insurance. But you do not put a digital treasury note in a physical warehouse. It doesn't rot and it doesn't catch fire. So we must redefine what carry means in Tom's world.
Okay, if I'm Tom and I'm holding $10 million in treasury notes, I'm not paying a warehouse fee. So what is my carrying cost?
In the financial markets, physical storage intuition is entirely replaced by interest rate mechanics. The cost of carry for a financial instrument is the mathematical relationship between two distinct rates, the income the asset generates and the cost to finance the purchase of that asset.
Break that down into an equation I can hold on to.
Carry equals the coupon income earned by the bond minus the short-term financing cost paid to hold the position. Income earned minus financing paid.
Okay, let's explore the mechanics of that financing cost. If Tom wants to hold $10 million in treasury bonds, he rarely uses $10 million of his own firm's cash. He uses leverage.
Right. He borrows the money. The standard mechanism for borrowing in this market is the repurchase agreement or the repo market. Tom effectively pawns his treasury bonds overnight to another financial institution in exchange for cash and agrees to buy them back the next day at a slightly higher price. That slight difference in price is the repo rate. It is his short-term financing cost.
So Tom is paying daily interest in the repo market to borrow the money. But at the exact same time, he's holding a treasury bond that is paying him a fixed coupon yield. Carry is just a battle between those two numbers.
Exactly. Carry is simply coupon yield minus repo rate.
Let me use a real estate analogy, because sometimes bond math feels invisible and abstract to me. Think about buying a rental house. You put a down payment on a house, but you borrow the rest from a bank, the coupon income that the bond pays you. That is the rent you collect from your tenant on the first of the month. The short-term financing repo rate. That is the mortgage payment you sent to the bank on the first of the month. The carry is just your net cash flow, rent collected minus mortgage paid.
That is an exceptional translation of the concept. Rent minus mortgage, coupon minus financing. And because it is a simple subtraction problem comparing two rates, the sign of the carry, whether it is positive or negative, depends entirely on which of those two rates is higher. This dictates whether the financial basis is positive or negative.
Okay, let's derive positive carry. If Terry is rent minus mortgage, then positive carry must mean I'm making a profit just by sitting on the couch.
Precisely. Positive carry occurs when the short-term financing rate you pay is numerically lower than the long-term yield you earn. The mortgage is cheaper than the rent.
Let's use Tom's numbers. Let's say Tom buys a 10-year treasury note that pays a 5% yield. To buy it, he borrows money in the overnight repo market at a 3% rate. He's collecting 5% and he is paying out 3%. He is netting a 2% profit every single day just for holding the position. His earnings beat his costs.
In the fixed income world, this is considered the normal, healthy state of the market. This scenario exists when the economy features a normal upward sloping yield curve, where short-term interest rates like repo are lower than long-term interest rates, like a 10-year treasury. When you have an upward sloping yield curve, financial assets naturally exhibit positive carry.
You are literally being paid to wait. But markets aren't always normal. What happens when the world flips upside down? Let's talk about negative carry.
Negative carry is the exact inverse. It occurs when the short-term financing rate you must pay is higher than the yield the instrument generates. Your mortgage payment is suddenly far more expensive than the rent you collect.
You are bleeding cash every single day. Let's look at Tom again. Say the Federal Reserve panics about inflation and aggressively hikes short-term interest rates. Suddenly, the overnight repo rate spikes to 6%. But Tom is still holding that 10-year treasury note that only pays a 5% fixed yield. He is earning 5%, but he has to pay 6% to finance it. He is losing 1% continuously.
His financing costs have totally overwhelmed his coupon income. This phenomenon typically occurs during an inverted yield curve, where short-term borrowing costs spike above long-term yields. When the yield curve inverts, the cost of carry goes negative, which fundamentally alters the basis relationship between the cash treasury bond and the treasury futures contract.
Exam trap alert. I'm blasting the siren on this one. Listener, please focus. Do not, under any circumstances, try to force Farmer Fred's physical storage intuition onto Treasury Tom's digital bonds. If you are reading a question on the Series 3 about the basis of a treasury bond or an interest rate future, and you start scanning the multiple choice answers for words like freight costs, warehousing, or insurance, you are in the completely wrong mental zip code.
The exam will absolutely mix the terminologies and the distractor answers to see if you are paying attention. A financial basis question is a rate story. It is exclusively a mathematical comparison of interest rates.
And remember the foundational rule to calculate it. Positive carry only happens when what you earn beats what you pay. The financing rate must be below the yield for the carry to be positive. If your costs exceed your earnings, you're negative. It is the most basic rule of business, applied to billions of dollars of sovereign debt.
The elegance of the basis is that the underlying formula cash minus futures never changes. But the inputs that drive that calculation adapt perfectly to whatever ecosystem you apply them to, whether it's the cost of diesel fuel moving corn across Illinois or the overnight repo rate financing government debt in Manhattan, the basis captures the friction of reality.
We have covered an incredible amount of terrain today. We've gone from the dusty, isolated silos of Farmer Fred down to the high-stakes vice grip of arbitragers forcing convergence to the finish line, through the emotional roller coaster of Baker Betty's profit margins, all the way to Treasury Tom's tailored suits and inverted yield curves. It's time to lock the doors and secure this information. Let's do a rapid-fire recap of the absolute most highly testable points from this entire deep dive. I'll prompt the concept expert. You deliver the professional exam-ready definition. Ready to break these down?
Let's do it. I'm ready.
Number one, the fundamental mathematical formula of the basis.
Basis equals the local cash price minus the futures price. It anchors to the physical reality of the spot market. You never invert the subtraction.
Number two, the geographic impact on the physical basis.
The greater the distance from the exchange-approved delivery point, the weaker or more negative the local basis will be. The local cash price must absorb the logistical penalty of freight costs. Distance drains value.
Number three, the behavior of the basis over time.
The basis converges, narrowing towards zero as the futures contract approaches expiration. It is driven by arbitragers exploiting price discrepancies during the delivery window. It does not stay constant, and it does not structurally widen into delivery.
Number four, the directional dance in profit margins.
A strengthening basis, which is movement upward becoming more positive or less negative, expands the profit margins of the short hedger and compresses the margins of the long hedger. A weakening basis movement downward expands the profit margins of the long hedger and compresses the margins of the short hedger. Always anchor your analysis to the short hedger who physically owns the asset.
Number five, the driver of the financial basis.
For financial derivatives like treasury futures, the basis is driven by the cost of carry, which is defined as the coupon yield earned minus the short-term repo financing rate paid. Positive carry requires financing costs to remain below the asset's yield.
Boom. That is the ultimate cheat code. If you internalize the why behind those five concepts, you are not just going to scrape by, you are going to absolutely dismantle the basis section of the Series 3. But before we sign off, we want to leave you with a final thought. A scenario to chew on that isn't strictly found in the textbook, but tests your true, gritty understanding of how all these gears turn together in the real world. Expert, hit them with the provocative final thought.
We've spent this hour discussing how physical constraints like distance warp the basis, and how under normal conditions, the magic of arbitrage forces convergence at the finish line. But consider the fragility of that mechanism. What happens to the basis of a physical commodity when an extreme localized crisis completely shatters the physical infrastructure? Imagine a massive Category 5 hurricane completely destroys the only deep water port, the major rail lines, and the highway bridges leading to an approved delivery point on the exact week the contract is supposed to expire. Suddenly, physical delivery is not just expensive, it is physically impossible.
Whoa, the finish line literally gets blown off the map.
Precisely. If arbitragers cannot physically move the commodity to the delivery point, they cannot execute the trade that forces the prices together. How violently would the local cash price and the theoretical futures price decouple right at the exact millisecond they are mathematically supposed to converge? The futures price might hold steady based on national data, but the local cash price at the destroyed port might plunge to zero because the commodity is suddenly stranded and useless. It highlights how a localized physical crisis can completely rewrite the mathematical rules of the market in real time, overriding theory with brute force reality.
The sticky note on the receipt catches on fire. That is a fascinating mental model to play with. Think about that, everyone. Let that scenario run wild in your head. You are now armed to the teeth with the mechanics, the intuition, and the math for this exam. Go out there, trust your foundation, and destroy it. Keep learning, keep questioning the mechanics behind the screen, and we will catch you on the next deep dive.